Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
This morning, I wanted to buy some decomposable coffee pods from a website. It was a frustrating experience because it seemed the only way to buy the pods was to sign up for a monthly subscription, which would have cost too much and left me over-caffeinated. Eventually, by actually leaving the site and doing a second search, I was able to find a hidden part of the website that would allow me to make a single purchase.
The company's decision to organize its website in such a frustrating way is an exercise in what is called choice architecture. Choice architecture is the act of organizing the context in which people make decisions. And choice architecture is everywhere, from school cafeteria arrays to retirement options offered by employers to healthcare plans. So what principles can and should choice architects utilize in arraying choices? How do people analyze and make choices? And what gets in the way of good decision-making, something that our guest today describes as sludge?
This morning, we are joined by Nobel Prize-winning economist Richard Thaler, the co-author of Nudge. Nudge is a deep and surprisingly humorous dive into how we make choices and how and why we can and should be nudged in different directions. We are so pleased that he has made the choice to join us this morning. Good morning, Professor Thaler.
Good morning. And I will point out that it was the default option for me to join.
Early in the book, you used the example that I just referenced of a school cafeteria to sort of explain the overall concept of choice architecture. Can you lay that out for our audience as background for our discussion?
Sure. So the idea is we have this imaginary person who, let's say, is in charge of all the school cafeterias for the city of Chicago, and would like the kids to eat healthier foods, and thinks about, well, how could you do that? And decides to run some experiments. They don't change the food they serve. They just rearrange how it's organized. And what she discovers is, if you put the apples where kids can see them and take them, they eat more apples and fewer Twinkies. And this is a made-up example, but it appeared in the first edition of the book, but then people tried it, and not surprisingly, it works. So it's an example both of choice architecture and nudging. So putting the healthy food up front is a nudge, and it's a nudge for good. The experience you had buying coffee pods was sludge, which is nudge for evil. When you go to a supermarket and all the stuff in the checkout line that's in easy reach of toddlers sitting in the cart is not the stuff that mom or dad wants the toddler to eat.
So you talked about, I guess, bad structure of these types of things, but perhaps go into what is paternalistic libertarianism and how should it drive choice architecture?
So libertarian paternalism is our preferred order. And so it is an odd phrase. And the fact that it annoys people, it was part of the appeal. But the idea is that, say, rearranging the order of the food is paternalistic in that we're trying to help the kids choose a healthier lunch, but it's libertarian in that we're not forcing anybody to do anything. Cass and I both love GPS because we're hopeless when it comes to getting around. We're always lost. Both of us rely on our wives to tell us where to go. But GPS, you know, when our wife isn't handy, GPS is a good substitute. And in our ideal world, there would be GPS for everything. And GPS lets you set where you want to go, but you can change your mind. And that's the way life ought to be. And, you know, when you're searching for coffee pods, it would be nice if the choice architecture led you to the most desirable option rather than the one that's most profitable for the seller.
And I apologize for bollocksing up libertarian paternalism. But it was interesting to me that, as you said before, those terms are seemingly contradictory. One doesn't associate paternalism with libertarians. So what I think you were trying to get at, and what I gathered from it, was that the concept of the libertarian comes from the fact that you're not limiting the choice. Have I got that right?
Exactly. We use libertarian as an adjective. It's a kind of paternalism. The phrase was invented on the fly when I was giving a talk here at the University of Chicago about a program that a student of mine and I invented called Save More Tomorrow. And the idea was you go to people in a 401k plan and say, would you like to sign up for a plan where you increase your saving contributions every year when you get a raise? It's voluntary. It's opt-in. Now, at this conference, there was an assigned discussant, which is normally assigned somebody to trash the paper in public in front of you. So my discussant said, well, yeah, this seems to work, but wait, isn't this paternalism, which is a curse word at the University of Chicago? And I said, well, you know, normally we think of paternalism as coercive. And you have to buckle your seatbelt. This seems to be a different kind of paternalism. I don't know, maybe we could call it libertarian paternalism, which of course he hated. But the next day at lunch with my buddy Cass Sunstein, I said, you know, Cass, I came up with an interesting phrase yesterday at this conference that seemed to annoy my discussant to no end. Maybe we should write a book about this. And, you know, there we go. The rest is history.
Well, and I think there's multiple ways to look at why it's important to offer and have offerings in this way, because, you know, traditional economics assume that people are rational actors, which I think we understand that we're not, you know, and we do seek optimum outcomes. But, you know, you talk about offering a different take and discussing, you know, concepts of human versus econs. So can you explain that?
Sure. So anybody who's ever taken an economics course knows that the creatures you study in an economics textbook are not people you've ever met. They can look at all the healthcare options offered by your employer and immediately figure out the best one. And the same with choosing a mortgage. And they never overeat. They eat just the right amount. So we call these fictional creatures econs. Econs never have a hangover because they don't drink too much. They save just the right amount for retirement. So, you know, back when I was in graduate school, I kept saying, really? You know, those aren't the people I know. So I've spent my career saying, you know, really? And so we say, no, there are not econs. There are humans. And we know humans can't make these kinds of calculations and sometimes have self-control problems, but are also nicer than economists give people credit for. They contribute to NPR, to charities, and clean up after campgrounds and clean up their dog mess, which economists think nobody would do. So Nudge is a book that says, what can we do to help humans? And, you know, economists, the Latin phrase for econs is homo economicus. And we say we study Homer economicus because we study Homer Simpson. And we're trying to create a world that is safe for Homer Simpson. And Homer would need a lot of help.
So you talk about some of the things that differentiate our Homer person from our econ. Share with us some of the things that humans do that distorts their decision-making and would be helped by nudges.
Well, you know, one is status quo bias. So we stick with what is done. And how many times have you been told when you say, why do we have to do it this way? And the answer is, that's the way we do it. Or that's the way we've always done it. Now, you know, there's the song and Fiddler on the Roof, tradition. Now, traditions are fine, but sometimes traditions are stupid. And we're just doing something because that's the way we've always done it. And status quo bias also leaves us continuing to do things even when we should change. So once you become aware of status quo bias, then you can say, oh, wait a minute, I'm falling into a trap here. And being aware of what those traps are helps protect you against some of the most common mistakes.
So knowing what the traps are, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the segment, Rogers going out and finding the coffee in the pods, but that it wasn't set up in the correct way. You know, it was set up to maximize profit, not necessarily to maximize the best decision-making process. Is that what sludge is, or is it also something else?
Well, it's partly that, but as we talked about, the government emits a lot of sludge as well. So companies may be trying to maximize profits. Governments, the phrase that law professors like Cass like to use is administrative burdens, which is sludge in and of itself, just that phrase. But the fact that you have to fill out a lot of forms to get some government benefit, that's an example of sludge. There is a new child credit that the poorest people will have the most trouble getting because they have to fill out some forms, and it's automatic if you've been paying taxes and have a bank account. Now, think of the typical homeless person or person living on the edge. If you don't make enough money, you don't have to pay tax, and you may not have a bank account. So the people who need the money most have the most trouble getting it. Does that make sense?
It does. And this has far and away been the most interesting and humorous conversation I can ever recall having with a professor of economics. And I was an economics major, so we really appreciate you taking the time with us. I know we're going to run out of time soon, but I wanted to touch on something you discussed in the last chapter, which is you're talking about climate change and the traditional economics challenge of dealing with public goods. Can you share with us a little bit about your observations as to how choice architecture could help with the climate change problem?
Sure. So, you know, the economists define a public good as something that everybody can share and will tend not to contribute to. So, you know, here in Chicago, there's a fireworks display twice a week at Navy Pier. I happen to live in a place in Lincoln Park where I see it from one of my windows. I don't have to pay for that. And it would be hard, you know, the mayor needs money, but she can't collect from me because there's no way to turn it off for me. So the economic theory says people won't contribute to public goods. But people are nicer than economists give them credit for. And so they will. And what experiments have shown is you can increase the extent to which people will do the right thing and contribute to the public good if people can punish people who don't. So how can we use that in dealing with climate change? Well, one of the many problems with climate change is we have to get all the countries to agree. And so the U.S. says, look, we don't want to, say, put in a carbon tax, which is what every economist, every 100% of economists say we need to have a carbon tax. But the U.S. says, well, look, we don't want to do that unless China and India do it. And they're emitting the most emissions. And China and India say, look, that's recent. The U.S. got rich by making all these emissions. So the U.S. should be cleaning up their act. Well, this isn't getting us anywhere. So what we need to do is something like the Paris Accord. We have to all agree to do our share. And the idea we endorse, which was proposed by Bill Nordhaus, an economist at Yale, is he calls them climate clubs. We're not sure that's the best name for it. But the idea would be all the countries would agree to do this and would agree to punish countries that don't take up their part of the deal, maybe through tariffs or something like that. So the other thing I'd like to say about climate change is, and one of the things we stress in the final edition of this book is that there are many things. Well, let me say it this way. Nudge can help almost any problem, including climate change. Nudge is not the solution to climate change. It's way too big. We're going to have to do some big things, and we have to get the prices right. That's step one. But nudges can help, and they can help with this. And there are lots of, you know, we get text messages now. If the heat is high and we're threatening the power grid, that's a nudge. That can help. And nudges may help 1-2%, but, and that's good. You know, President Obama used to like to say, good, better is good, you know? So every little bit helps, but that problem is so big, we're going to have to go beyond nudging. And that's what we say in the new book.
We've been talking with Professor Richard Thaler, who is a co-author with Professor Cass Sunstein of Nudge, the final edition. Thank you for spending time with us. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.